Hey everyone, and welcome to No Planet B, a podcast where we're talking about climate change and its effect on planet A. I'm Wyatt.
He's Wyatt, and I'm Brianna. This week we're talking about sustainable cities and how climate change will potentially interact with cities in general. Are cities ready? Guess we'll find out.
I guess we'll have to find out. This week we interviewed Dr. David Fulch of FSU. He has a master's in economics, a PhD in geography, and he's published in fields like geocomputation, GIS science, and urban analytics. This episode was really fun to do, and it's a really good follow-up to our Sea Level Rise episode if you haven't listened to that one already.
Go listen.
Yeah, so here's Dr. David Fulch. I hope you guys enjoy. So for people who are unaware, what is a smart city?
A smart city is a city that leverages sensors, data, algorithms to address urban challenges and improve quality of life for the residents.
Awesome. It's a really pertinent thing right now, and we really wanted to talk about that in conversation with climate change.
Yeah, and I think it's there are two topics that are interrelated, and there's a lot of overlap between them. And some things I think are happening today, and I think there's a lot more that we'll see happening in the future.
The future. Okay. So how do you think climate change is going to affect city planning?
So I think it's a big question in terms of, so one of the issues is that cities were for a long time built near coasts and major waterways. 150 years ago, it was pretty difficult to move goods around except via water. And so today it's different. We have trains and airplanes and trucks to move goods around. But what we're dealing with is a lot of cities that have grown up around waters, around coasts. And so if you think about issues like sea level rise, a lot of cities are going to be pretty dramatically impacted by that. Even in the United States, you can think about 40 to 50% of the population living near a coast. And so there's a potential for a big impact. And so as you think about what's going to happen, you think about sort of if there's sea level rise, we're likely going to see a lot of people displaced, where people are going to have to choose what they're going to do. And so some people may consider moving to more inland cities. And at a more micro scale, you can see people choosing to just move to higher ground. And I think issues that cities are going to have to contend with going forward is differences in elevation even within a city, where certain areas are going to be more likely to be impacted by inundation, more likely to be flooded. And we might see cities having to deal with issues of property values changing over time. And so there's a lot going on there. And I think one of the big issues that underlies a lot of this is the socioeconomics of it. Specifically, who are the people that are going to be impacted by climate change? And cities are going to have to face choices about how they choose to protect the city, what neighborhoods possibly get levies and what neighborhoods are potentially abandoned because they're too dangerous for people to live.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be, I don't expect it to be coincidental on which neighborhoods are the ones that may be left to go underwater and those that are protected. And so there's a lot of interrelated issues. And so cities are going to have to do, the inland cities are going to have to deal with new population coming in. These are cities that already have their own challenges that they're dealing with. And the additional pressure on them from new residents is going to be a big deal. The coastal cities themselves are going to have to deal with the sort of the micro scale issues, neighborhood to neighborhood issues about where inundation is more or less likely going to happen. And these are, of course, in a Florida context where sea level rise is kind of the big issue.
Scary stuff, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I definitely agree. Like, I can't even begin to imagine, like, when we're in our 50s, like, what the sea, like, level is going to... I don't know, like, I can't imagine just going to an old beach I used to like go to as a kid, and it's just like completely transformed by the time I'm an adult. Like that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
So
it's going to be more traumatic as if your neighborhood is transformed.
Yeah,
like your old childhood home.
Yeah, no, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Do you think that up until like now, cities are prepared for this kind of thing? Like, do you think that cities have defenses against these type of like sea level rise and natural disasters impending?
Well, I think the point you just made about, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now is pretty critical in the sense that the issues when this is going to get really serious is still pretty far off in the future. And so I think it's tricky because people and politicians tend to be a little bit short-sighted. They tend to be reactionary. Cities are dealing with problems today, you know, like crime or gentrification, traffic, school performance. All these kind of issues are like today problems, or maybe they're next year or 2 years from now problems. And it's easy to see a city being focused on the near term. So what are these things? What are the things that the citizens are most clamoring for? And so I think until we see climate change really impacting people's pocketbooks, we might not see a lot of action on the part of cities. And what's important there is like, and it's not that we don't have the technology, right? We've been building seawalls and levees and dams for forever. Our fire departments have a lot of technology. They're very sophisticated. Police departments, these are all very sophisticated entities today in 2019. But it's a question of allocation of resources and time about whether cities are going to, you know, how prepared they are today for a problem that may not manifest itself dramatically for another 20, 30, 40 years. I think, you know, one of the areas I think that may be interesting is insurance companies you know, in terms of how they treat this, because they deal with this on sort of micro scale. So for example, my house in Tallahassee, I get a reduction on my insurance rate because my roof is apparently built in a way that's not susceptible to hurricane winds. So that's a good thing. Yeah. And I had an inspector came out to my house and he looked at it, he made some measurements and did the thing. Surprisingly though, they didn't increase my rates due to all the trees that are around my house. Because when one of these hurricanes hit a couple years ago, two of those trees fell and crushed my deck. One of them came and pierced my bedroom ceiling.
Oof.
So it's interesting. I think it'll be interesting to see the insurance companies and sort of the models that they start to do, and as they get more sophisticated around these stronger storms that we're seeing, and start to give me a micro, you know, a very small push to make changes. And, you know, and so as we see those kind of things really starting to hit people where maybe the insurance company says, well, the elevation of your house is too low, and so we're going to charge you more money for your homeowner's insurance, that could have a real impact on home prices. And so people have to start thinking about, well, if I buy this house, my homeowner's insurance is going to be X. If I buy that other house, it's going to be twice as much as that. And so once those things start to really kick in, I think we're going to see this. We're going to see citizens clamoring more for some sort of changes that can affect them.
I think one of the, we've talked about this, I think in literally our last episode, was that you see a lot of people saying, oh, well, let's get prepared for this because here's like what's going to happen. But the way it seems that like politics work in America is that something isn't going to happen until people voting are going to have to be dealing with it like in their everyday. Like they're not going to be advocating, they're not going to be, you know, voting for these things until it's something that it becomes less of a threat and more of a reality. Exactly. And I think that's kind of scary.
And exactly. People don't want to pay for things that they don't, you know, that they don't see.
Exactly.
And so, and I think cities are going to be on the hook. You know, there's the issue of how cities are going to be retrofitted. You know, it's going to be expensive and somebody's going to have to pay for it. And and the politician that stands up and says, I'm going to, you know, indirectly raise your taxes by, in a way of houses have to be retrofitted in a certain way or something, you know, that politician's going to have a tough time at reelection. When the opponent's saying, well, you know, this isn't a problem for 20 years. Why are we making people make these expensive changes to their homes, to their businesses? Mm. Why are we making all these expensive infrastructure changes for a problem that's far away?
Yeah. So kind of going a little closer to smart cities, there are kind of two ways that I've seen smart cities and climate change in conversation. One being climate change mitigation and one being climate change adaptation. And I was wondering, do you have any like examples of some smart city initiatives that can mitigate climate change and maybe some that like adapt to it?
Yeah, there's a lot on the mitigation side. There's a lot, you know, in terms of basically cities trying to reduce their sort of greenhouse gases, their sort of carbon footprint. Mm. You know, in the sense of, you know, cities encouraging people to use renewable energy, smart grids where they have a better handle on their utilization of power, informing residents when they're maybe above average usage of power compared to their neighbors. Cities are optimizing their physical resources in terms of like their trash trucks, getting them to be the garbage trucks running more efficiently, more efficient routes, you know, air quality sensors throughout the city, knowing which parts of the city have air quality problems so that then you can develop strategies to deal with that. So there's a lot on that side that cities can help. And, you know, from a global perspective, we've got over 50% of the world's population living in cities. And so these little changes that cities can do can have a big impact in the aggregate. In terms of sort of the other side of it, which is sort of how we deal with sort of, let's say, sea level rise, for example, in terms of technological solutions. With smart cities, a lot of the strength around smart cities is the now issue. So we can put sensors, sensors are cheap. So we can put them in a lot of places, so we get high spatial density of information. They are connected to the internet, so we get live information from the sensors. And they really help making sort of micro-scale, fine-tuning kind of changes, make them possible. And so I'm not seeing as many of those things in terms of the sort of climate change mitigation going on today. But I do think there's a lot of cool stuff that's out there that's a potential. Something that people are talking about are things like smart levees, where levees might be inflatable so that they can adapt to different types of climate issues. So sort of with hurricanes or droughts or whatever the issue might be, the levees can adapt to those things.
Wow, that's cool.
And I think that's kind of the issue is adaptable infrastructure going forward. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty around the magnitude of climate change. And so if new infrastructure that's being built is adaptable and can address multiple scales of challenges, sort of the near-term things like hurricanes and floods that are going to be stronger in the near future, and then also can be relevant 30, 40, 50 years from now, when maybe sea level rise is becoming more of a pressing issue. So I think those are things that are in play. And you know, you guys were talking about sort of getting people's awareness. I think there's other issues in terms of technology that can help raise awareness. So for example, augmented reality, where you know, where you're saying like, what if I, you know, imagine going to the beach, you know, 30, 40 years from now where I spent time as a kid. Well, imagine if you had a set of augmented reality glasses on where you're standing at that beach today and you can dial in sort of 50 years from now and
a particular
climate change scenario and actually see through the glasses superimposed what it would actually look like under that climate change scenario. And I think those are the kind of things that if you get those kind of tools in the hands of citizens, in the hands of politicians, they can, you know, makes this more tangible to them today to think about the small changes to be made today to affect sort of bigger stuff in the future.
Yeah, does that already exist or is that a hypothetical?
Well, there are people that are talking about it. I've seen a lot of these things are talking. But we're not that far away. And these are the kind of things that are often seeded at tech expos where they're trying to get people together to do small demo projects.
Yeah.
Because the augmented reality software is out there. If you play Pokemon Go, you see Pokemon superimposed on the city. That's all fun and games. But imagine instead of a Pokemon, you know, you're seeing, you know, a car floating by.
Sharks.
because you're simulating a Category 5 hurricane that directly hits Miami.
Yeah.
And so that's where we're there. It's implementing it is a smaller challenge than actually the raw technology to do it. We've got that technology today.
Yeah. Someone should talk to I know Noah has the visualizer of like how many years from now and like what locations, and you can see like where sea level is predicted to be. I wonder if there could be like some conversation between that and then just like an app that can read that information and interpret it into like AR. That would be so cool.
Exactly. That's what I mean. I think the data's there and the technology's there. It takes somebody to sort of put them together and make the app. So, and there's a lot of smart people out there that in that space that can do that kind of thing.
Yeah. So some of like climate change mitigation in smart city technology could just be like information.
Yeah, I think today is that there's a lot of education out there, and again, there's how to educate the population. There was a cool article in Nature two months ago, where they were showing analogs, where essentially is saying, okay, if you live in Washington D.C. in 50 years from now, a lot for this particular climate scenario, which current city has the climate that is most similar to Washington, D.C. 50 years from now. And it's a really neat way to see that, like, oh, I've been to, and I don't remember the exact city, but let's say it was Memphis. And you say, oh, yeah, I've been to Memphis in the summer. I know what the climate's like there. Mm. And it's like, okay, well, this other city is now going to be like Memphis or Tallahassee or whatever. And so
yeah.
those kind of things that make people, that make it more tangible, I think are really important to do today to then get politicians more engaged with these problems and hearing their citizens actually being more engaged. Because the reality is that politicians hear this. They get briefings from their staff. Their staff knows all this stuff is coming. But you know they've got to deal with the ballot box, and so getting the population more engaged I think is really important.
Yeah. I agree. Because this is something that we want to keep relatively like pertinent to everyone. I think in our last episode about sea level rise, we talked about Miami and how they're dealing with like flooding streets today. Do you know any examples of smart city initiatives in Florida that might be helping to deal with these problems that people are like facing every day?
In terms of Florida specific examples, I don't have any. But I can't say that Florida's really engaged with emergency management planning, training like state employees, city employees. They spend a lot of time prepping for emergency management questions. These cities, especially the staff, are quite aware of what's going on. And I know that in a lot of cities, especially you know Miami, the South Florida places, are really thinking ahead in terms of what they anticipate to happen in terms of sea level rise, those kind of questions. So sizing new infrastructure to be relevant to that. So I think there's a high level of awareness. In terms of specifics, I don't have a lot, but I know that we spend a lot of time in Florida thinking about it.
Yeah, that's fair. And speaking of specifics, this one might be a little too specific as well, but when you read about smart cities, at least for me, with the cursory research that I've done, a lot of times Singapore comes up, and Singapore just sounds like the most wild, like they can get anything done kind of city. Like they're really ahead with like smart mobility, safety, clean energy, stuff like that. Is there anything we can learn from cities like Singapore that are already like pretty advanced as far as smart city technology?
Yes, there definitely is. I think also the political structure is something that would also need to be considered.
I see.
In places that have, I think Singapore was the country a few years ago that was, you know, throwing gum on the ground would get you thrown in jail. So in places where there's a little bit more of a culture of control, I think it's easier to implement more dramatic policies. And so that, I think that's, you know, we, in the United States, that's going to be different. People don't sort of, people want to have more freedom. And so telling me that, you know, I'm going to build a new house and, you know, the overhang of the roof can only be so many feet, or inches even, you know, people are going to push back against that kind of stuff. So I think there's a cultural aspect of, and a political aspect that comes into play. But in terms of the technological advances, definitely. A lot of countries are doing some really exciting stuff. And these coastal places, Hong Kong, Singapore, I think what they're doing, I think we should definitely be looking to them for ideas.
Very cool.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. And you studied economics in your bachelor's and your master's, right?
Yes.
If cities were to take on new climate change oriented smart city initiatives, like if they were to start creating them, would there be any economic like hindrances to that, or even like incentives? Like how could that be helpful or hurtful in like an economic way?
So you can think about it from a couple perspectives. Businesses don't like uncertainty.
Mm.
And so for cities to be clear about things is going to be a benefit from the business side of city growth. And so if it's very clear in this place, we are aware of climate change. Everybody that's building a new factory, a new office building has to do this. We're doing it for this reason, because we, you know, we are going to be a city that withstands climate change, and we are going to thrive. And we have this plan. The city is going to implement this infrastructure. The private sector is going to change their building practices. Those kind of things, when it's very clear, I think cities are going to be able to weather the storm a little bit better. But in the near term, it costs real money. And there's a real trade-off in sort of economic development strategy, which is sort of the idea of advertising even. Do I spend money to make money?
Mm.
So do I incentivize homeowners, or incentivize business owners by giving them some sort of a rebate if they build in a certain way? So to maybe share the cost across all the citizens of the city for the maybe infrastructure changes that are only needed in part of the city. The idea is thinking about the big picture. We want those jobs. We want that factory. We want that office building. And so everybody kind of shares a little bit of the pain to make sure that we get those jobs, and they're here for everybody to actually go and work at. So thinking about these things more strategically and thinking about the big pictures is challenging for cities. And certainly we've seen incentives in the news recently with Amazon and their you know goal to, you know, to squeeze everything they can out of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
can backfire sometimes. But I think as citizens sort of see the trade-off of, you know, incentives are reasonable, everybody's sharing the cost for things for a better outcome for everybody, then I think it's very doable. And that can be done. I think the potential is it can be done actually quite well, if well thought out.
Yeah, well, that's awesome to hear. I do love that.
It'll be interesting if we see in the future inland cities starting to market themselves.
Yeah.
As climate change proof.
Oh, I hope so.
Try to put some branding around that. If you start to see Atlanta and Phoenix and Salt Lake City, Denver, you know, saying, hey, you know, climate change isn't going to affect us. You should, you know, you're going to open a new branch office, a new warehouse.
Yeah.
Put it here.
Come on in. Like a visitatlanta.com says, we're not going to be underwater.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's pretty ironic because Atlanta has some of the worst air quality in the country.
But, is that true?
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's totally true. I mean, no, those are the issues that's the thing we were talking about with migration is people that are in a big city today. Let's say they have a job that tends to be located in big cities. Well, all of a sudden, the Atlantas and Phoenixes and Denvers are going to start to attract those people, and they're going to feel even more pressure around sprawl, around transit, around traffic. That they might not, you know, they might not be prepared for or have thought enough about if they get all these climate related migrants.
So we're gonna do a little experimental section. I like to call it
freeform.
Yes. this is more of like, I'd love to hear your response rather than just like a typical question. So mm-hmm. Are you excited about that?
Go for it.
All right. Okay. Here we go. So our sensible president, Donald Trump, tweeted, windmills are the greatest threat in the U.S. to both bald and golden eagles. Media claims fictional global warming is worse. That was it.
That was it.
Oh, what's my reaction?
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts?
What's my reaction? I like birds. Birds do get chopped up in wind farms. So the other side of that is that doesn't mean we need to get rid of wind farms as much as we need to think about what's an annoying sound that will convince the bird not to fly near the wind to fly near the wind farm. You know, like what is a simple strategy to keep the birds away? And, you know, I mean, and cynically, you know, one of the issues that Trump has is that wind farms are often an offshore, in a lot of countries, wind farms are an offshore technology. And specifically around the UK, where he has a golf resort, something, hotel facility. Mm-hmm. And so people complain about their views. So they say, well, wind farms are great as long as it doesn't obstruct my view of the sea and my, and so he may be a little bit motivated from that economic perspective of saying, well, my property is going to lose value if you plop a bunch of wind turbines right off the coast of my lovely golf resort.
Yeah.
So I think his economic incentives are maybe skewing his view on this. And in the United States, the issue is more of these wind farms in, let's say, Colorado. Yeah, where birds do, you know, there is a risk to birds, and that's true. But I think you can mitigate that risk with a little bit of further technology and research.
That was a great analysis. Thank
you. Yeah, that was a lot more. That was a lot more of an answer than I expected to get from that one. Actually, that was very good.
Thank you for your comment.
I like wind farms. They're very. It's a Me very too. Interesting. It's an interesting technology.
Pro windmill, pro bird.
Yeah.
What states have the most wind farms? Do we know? Or what area of the country?
I don't know.
You know, I think it's
like, definitely a coastal thing. And yeah. I know. I've seen them. When I was living in Colorado, I saw them. Colorado is just a place, anecdotally, that's the windiest place I've ever lived.
Oh, really?
So I'm not surprised that they have these giant turbines out there. I mean, I've seen them, you know, in California, Southern California. I've seen them a lot of places.
Yeah, they're actually pretty popular in, like, the plains in Illinois. That's where I'm from, so... Yeah. There's just, like, so much open space with, like, the cornfields and stuff, so...
Got to use that space for something.
Exactly.
So we also have a couple of listener questions, just people from social media. We like gave them the context of this interview, and so they had a couple questions. And these may be on topic, off topic a little bit. So this one's actually pretty good. What actions will city planners take to ensure just distribution of resources in the context of like climate change adaptation? Because I remember you said earlier, actually, that you didn't think it was going to be a coincidence which like neighborhoods were going to be preserved and which ones were going to be kind of behind.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of political power in this, which is so there's a couple of interesting issues. So something like flooding, for example, we in general know where flooding is going to happen. We know which side of the when the river overflows, we know which side of the river more of the water is going to go onto. I experienced a flood when I lived in Boulder, Colorado, and it was a major flood. A couple people died. Oh. And when it came to my property, the water came exactly to the line that all of the models predicted is where the water stopped. So we have a good idea of that. Another side of natural disasters are things like wildfires and hurricanes. And it's often the case that the people that are living on the urban fringe are wealthy people that have their cabin out in the forest, and they're the ones who are more likely to lose their house due to a wildfire. Similarly, a lot of coastal areas have a lot of really big fancy mansions around them, where people have political power and money to argue that, you know, what areas should be protected. And so if you think back to Hurricane Katrina, you know, it's not coincidental which neighborhoods got flooded in that hurricane, because the issue wasn't the hurricane itself. It wasn't the wind. It was the water that was really what was so damaging and what killed so many people. And those neighborhoods were lower value, lower income areas because they were below sea level. And the higher areas, the French Quarter and other districts of New Orleans, did, you know, okay. I mean, not great, but they did okay. You know, from that hurricane. And so I think there's going to be a lot of political pressure on cities to be equitable in how they allocate these resources. And it's really tough when you just look at a model and you say the total home value of this neighborhood is X and the total home value of this other neighborhood is half of that. Well, you know, there's an economic argument even telling you, well, we should protect that higher value area versus this lower value area. The problem is that the people in those two places are not of equal social power, historically underrepresented groups. And that takes a lot of fortitude from city planners and from elected officials to really be aware of that and to recognize that in their planning decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a pretty like charged up one. Now this one says, do you think like wolves will learn to swim? Because holy shit, that would be so cool. And so it's goofy. It's a weird one for sure. But like, I don't know, maybe it's a metaphor with us being wolves and learning to adapt with climate change.
I'm glad I just learned something today. I did not know that wolves couldn't swim. My dog swims very well, so I'm surprised.
It's a fair point.
I think there's going to be, I think there's going to be adaptation. The time sort of the Darwin, you know, we're not talking about Darwinian timelines here though. So, the adaptations are going to have to happen a lot quicker than what we learned in school. I do think we're going to adapt. I think people are going to adapt. I think issues of if real estate agents start advertising their houses as they start including the elevation of the house in the real estate ad, you know, people are going to start to adapt.
Yeah.
I do think we're going to adapt in this. It's just the speed of adaptation that's unclear.
Yeah. That's very fair.
And so what we choose to protect in terms of cities, you know, if you think about New Orleans was a city that was sort of economically on the decline, largely going into Hurricane Katrina. And so, you know, it's a question of, you know, what do we choose to protect? And, you know, it's a really tricky question. Like, what places should adapt and what places should that maybe the cost is too high the cost of adaptation is going to be so prohibitive that we need to, you know, think of other approaches.
Yeah, that's a very salient and kind of hopeful note, I think, to end the interview on, unless Bree, do you have any other questions?
I thought we were going to ask that wildfire question.
The wildfire one? We can.
Sorry to put you on the spot, buddy.
So we did get a question, and as someone from Colorado, maybe this is going to be pretty rough to hear. This was a question we got that just says, what if I'm pretty okay with wildfires?
You know, right. So it's funny. So I spent most of my life in the West.
Yeah.
I grew up in Phoenix. I've lived in Colorado. I've lived in San Diego. When I lived in San Diego, there was a wildfire that was so strong, even from inside the city at night, you could see, the fire way, way off in the distance. I mean, our house was not in any sort of danger. It was so far away, but at night you could see the flames kicking up on the hillsides. I don't know. I guess probably the people in Colorado are saying, hey, all you folks in Miami, why are you so, you know, just move out of Miami. You know, you can go somewhere else. But wildfires are a big deal. As the climate gets even drier, it's just so much easier for the most trivial thing to start up a major fire. And so, you know, somebody just camping and, you know, out there camping and maybe even trying to do the right thing, their car backfires and they don't notice their car backfiring. It leaves a spark and everything's so dry that it just starts to go and go and go. And so one of the big issues with wildfires is they go unnoticed long enough that it's difficult to get them under control.
Yeah.
And so the same issue with sensors is we think about sensors to detect sea level rise, sensors to detect things.
I was just about to ask you about sensors for this.
Yeah. And so if you can have sensors that are out there that are just cheap and easy, that can hopefully catch a wildfire while it's still small, then,
or even one that could say, hey, the humidity is like dangerously low.
Yeah. And right now, I mean, the humidity is almost always dangerously low in the West.
Yeah.
And it's just going to get worse. So out here in Florida, you know, the big thing we worry about is hurricanes, and hurricanes are, we know they're coming. We might not know exactly where it's going to hit. We might not know exactly the strength when it makes landfall, but they're not surprises. But wildfires, tornadoes, other hazards are oftentimes a surprise. And when we, with a wildfire, for example, by the time we notice it, it's often too big to easily contain. And then we got to deal with that aftermath.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Wildfires aren't a joke, kids.
No. And that question was,
wildfires are something real for me. So
exactly. Yeah. That's kind of why I didn't want to ask it.
Honestly, no, and it's funny, you know, when I moved to Florida, like, I had no clue about hurricanes.
Yeah.
I knew about them from the news, like, there was a hurricane, it was bad.
And songs.
But, like, how you prepare, you know, like, when I, like, after the first hurricane that I experienced in Tallahassee, I didn't realize the importance of cash. Like,
oh, yeah.
People were telling me, like, oh, I've got a bunch of cash. I'm like, why do you have a bunch of cash? And then I realized when the power's out for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
If you want to make a transaction,
it's the Wild West.
Credit card's not going to be very useful to you. So yeah, all those, I had to learn all of that stuff. you know, when I've gone through three hurricanes now, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. How were they for like your first three?
The first one was pretty bad.
Which one was it?
That was Hermine.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was my first hurricane. And that's the one where we lost a deck. We had a branch pierce the roof of the house. And yeah, we were just thoroughly, yeah, it was quite a new experience for us.
Surprising. Yeah. I think Hermine was the one. I think I actually, right after Hermine came around, I did start a small yard cleaning business.
Oh, really?
I did, yeah.
That's so interesting. I
put up signs saying, like, we'll clean, college kids will clean yard. It was me and my friend. And I got just enough money to, like, buy an Xbox or something after that one.
Nice, yeah. I mean, honestly, I treated it as exercise. I had to haul my crushed deck up to the street. And
wow.
It was like, do not need to go to the gym this month. It's like, so.
It's the benefits.
Yeah, that's the way I look at it.
Mm. Cool. Well, do you have any more questions?
No.
I think we're good.
Yeah.
I think that's enough meat and potatoes. Thank you for doing this, by the way. Before I hit stop recording, this has actually been very fun and very informative.
Cool. Good. No, it's been a lot of fun for me too. It's an important topic. I'm glad to talk about it.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Wow, what a fun interview to listen to and to have conducted in the past. Thank you, Dr. David Folch, for doing this interview with us.
Thanks, Big Dave.
Thank you, Big Dave, or as you guys may know him, Regular Dave. Yeah, really fun interview to do.
Give our Twitter and Insta a follow, guys. Our Twitter is NoPlanetBcast, and our Insta is NoPlanetBFSU, where we are going to keep the alternative facts from occurring and giving you sources.
Yeah, and if you listen to this on iTunes and you enjoyed it, give it a 5 stars, tell your friends.
Sorry, Androids.
Sorry, Androids. I don't really know exactly if that's how that works. But yeah, thank you so much for listening, and have a good rest of your day or night, and we'll see you on the internet.